Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
QNL.
With guest co-host
Imran Siddiqui.
That's right, pick on the new co-host. Pick on the new co-host. It's not me anymore.
Welcome to Polycast episode 85, our first outing for the 2010 season, season 4. I'm Daniel Dank Hugh Quick, and I'm joined by Makalua.
More coffee still needed.
Philip, the main team.
I'm so 2010. Your show 2000 and when?
How long did he take to think that one up?
A couple minutes before the show.
Lisa Bang, QNL.
Hi.
And our guest co-host, Imran Siddiqui.
Me? Guesting?
Oh.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so what's up with that?
He got fired.
Who invited him back?
We've run over our smart-ass quota.
In the news, every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end. Imran Siddiqui leaving the Polycast regular panel, and Lisa Bang joining it.
In Forum Talk today, we discussed whether the AI actually cares whether it wins or not, or does it actually just want to stop you. And then we discussed the different strategies and algorithms you can use to maximize trade routes. Then we talked about defensive versus offensive military. And lastly, AI reference charts, specifically the one created by Atronox.
In Research Lab, we discussed yet another potential solution to Stacks of Doom!
Here's what's been making news in the Civ community.
Imran is no longer a regular co-host on the show. The short answer is Imran just doesn't have the time to be a regular co-host anymore, unfortunately, due to other commitments in life. Imran is going to be on our guest co-host rotational, so this isn't goodbye forever, but this is goodbye on a regular basis, which actually, if you consider back of the original four that were on the show, Locutus left at the end of season one to be on Modcast, and he's still on Modcast. So Imran leaving, you're the first of the original four to actually leave the regular co-hosting family of Polycast podcasts here.
Wow. And Mackie's probably thinking, why didn't I do this first? You could leave? I never knew this.
The fact that Imran has been on the show as regular co-host for three seasons, the longest serving regular co-host on any show to then be departing from that position. So given that Imran has been here from the beginning along with Mackie and I on Polycast, it's going to be a considerable change, I must say.
You might actually have to hire someone that knows something about Civ.
Don't worry, we won't run out of smartass.
Yeah, so the smartass is going to have to be distributed across the remainder of us. We won't be able to compress it all into one person again, but we'll figure out a way. We'll try.
First of all, I thought it was a decent breaking point in terms of the new year. And like Dan has said, I'm having a little less time recently anyway. As Dan has probably noticed, I've missed a few late last year. Also, I realize that my comparative lack of Civ playing is getting to be a bit ridiculous and is not helpful in terms of game stuff, if that makes much sense.
Now, because Imran, you've been on the show since the beginning, as I said, and yes, you haven't been on every episode, but you have been on more than 50 episodes of the show over the past 3 years.
Oh, no. All this time.
So what I have done in recognition of the time that you have spent on the show, put together a little farewell clip. I really did want a notable portion of this episode dedicated to you, because it's not every day that someone who's been a regular co-host for 3 years leaves, and I wanted you to get a send-off that was kind, but also reflective of your time on the show. So with those two things competing... No.
What?
Here it is, the Imran farewell.
This will give you practice at cutting my nonsense out when you don't have to cut out Imran's nonsense. See? You know, the bratty one.
The bratty one.
Imran Siddiqui.
Polycast regular co-host, seasons 1 to 3, 2006 to 2009.
Does this make it into bloopers or just gets cut?
Both.
Oh, it all gets cut.
I think the majority of Dan's editing is just Imran.
Yeah, that's probably right.
Well, it was before I joined. Now it might... I'm getting...
That's what she said. What?
This is a family-friendly show.
Too late.
Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah. Oops. Hold on.
Don't put mute on.
We want to hear your phone call.
And if you're a woman playing Civ...
No. Whatever you're about to suggest, no.
Send in more.
Well, okay, that's all right. Other suggestions.
Please play in your underwear.
No.
Now, children.
Calm down. I'll turn this podcast around, I swear.
You're really making a good first impression here, Imran. It's our new guest co-host.
I do this with everyone.
I did listen to a couple of the podcasts before, so I know this is par for the course. It's okay.
Okay. I've been parred.
That's what I was going to say. Oh, no. Imran and I should not be on the same wavelength.
Oh, no. We're sharing a brain.
No.
I think all four of us have started sharing a brain at some point.
I actually told someone yesterday, one of my friends, well, she was saying, like, tomorrow, get some lunch. I was like, I have something I have to do in the morning. And then I explained to her that I do this. And she was like, oh, that sounds cool. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. I know what civilization is. I was like,
marry her.
Oh, I'm not going to marry her. There was the one time where I had to leave, and I fortunately forgot to put my microphone on mute.
So here's the debut clip.
He's not gone.
Yeah. Imran hasn't hung up yet. What's going on? Whoa.
Oh.
Hey, that sounded like he had the cell phone back on vibrate or something. I wonder if he just left but didn't hang up the call.
What?
How you going?
Is everyone?
Hello.
How you going?
So, we're thinking dinner at 7, and then we're
going to
movie.
Okay, what movie would you like to see?
7 and half. Okay. So, I guess I'll see you then. What?
What?
Changing the life of Imran.
Excuse me? No, I said 7, and I guess I'll see you there. Yeah, yeah. So... 7. Alright, it's a plan.
Alright, and then afterwards we'll eat. Or afterwards we'll watch a movie.
Alright,
bye.
I guess we're
going to
go to
leave,
so here
you call that. I think he really doesn't realize he didn't turn it off. I don't think so either. The toilet?
That's the toilet, man!
Stop it, he made me the plunger!
Oh, that sounds like the Imran show is over. It was just getting good. I think he's gone now.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's very quiet. I think Imran has left the building.
waiting to be reinvited.
Back in, back in.
I love me.
What?
I was hoping you'd have the most infamous Enron clip ever in there.
I've only heard about that one.
That's the first time that even Mackie had heard that since it was actually recorded. So that was from episode 16. So, you know, I've been sitting on this clip for 2.5 years. Just waiting for the right time to get some kind of insight into some of the stuff that gets cut. And there was some strategic bleeping still. Yeah, so you finally got to hear the infamous clip. We've mentioned that in past on the show. We've alluded to it, but we've never actually played that before.
I wonder what movie I was seeing that day.
Once again, thank you, Imran, for your 3 seasons as a regular co-host, coming back from time to time. And if anybody out there has not listened to all the episodes Imran has been on, since this is the start of a new season anyway, this is a good time to catch up on your Polycast, go back through the archives. Is there anything that you're going to remember most from your time as a regular co-host on the show?
Most? There are so many things. I think probably the most thing that most comes to mind is the interplay between you and Mackie.
Really?
Well, you know what I'm talking about, like
me telling him to stop singing and stuff.
Well, I do anyway.
Yeah.
Or something more basic than that, which is like the obvious flirting. Is that
there? That one. And the singing. And I really enjoyed the period where we had you, me, Mackie, and Anna Lee. That was fun.
What are you trying to say here, Imran?
Who are you again?
Well, I know. It's only like the third time we've been on the show together, but still.
Oh, yeah. And some of those episodes when Anna Lee and Alexander were on this program together and they were sharing a computer. Those were amusing. Oh, yes, and various technical difficulties, such as, I forget who it was, but someone was using a laptop that made this ungodly noise.
I remember. Does Mackie remember? I know who exactly you're talking about.
Trip?
Yes, John Schaefer.
That's right.
So, John, if you're still listening to the show, I hope you've gotten a microphone that's separate from your built-in laptop mic.
Built-in laptop mic, apparently right next to the fan.
And, of course, episode 50.
With Sid Meier, yes. I would say that what I'm going to remember the most is all of the innuendo that I had to bleep, or more likely, completely from the show. Even before that's what she said, there were as that's what she said moments before you actually started using that expression. I also remember, and some people have said this as well, even the interplay between you and I, perhaps earlier on in the show.
Mm.
When you were able to be around more often, including the 2 episodes that just you and I ourselves, because
that was kind of funny.
Episodes 4 and 6, before we were getting guests on a regular basis, so it was just the two of us.
Just the two of us.
We can make it if we try. Sorry, Mackie.
Sorry. I had to come. If she didn't say it, I was going to.
So, any other comments for or on Imran that's flattering and constructive?
And not bleepable.
Oh, well, that takes everything I might say out.
Going from that, why don't we just introduce Lisa. Lisa Bang, who goes by Q&L on the forums. You guested a couple of times last season, most recently episode 83. If you haven't listened to that, listen to the bloopers for Lisa's own version of the Mackie rap, which, I don't know, may even be superior to the Mackie rap, dare I say.
I wouldn't go that far.
Lisa, did you have anything you wanted to say to the Polycast audience as you join as the newest regular co-host on the show?
Really excited to be joining Polycast, and in Ross's memory, I'll try to say that's what he said a couple times. No promises, but I'll try.
It's just not as good.
Yay!
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
Does the AI care if it wins? Zero Sum, he's asking, does the AI, it only cared if he won, not if they won. Basically, they would sacrifice any attempts at actually winning in order to crush him.
Yeah, no, the AI does not care. The AI is just coded to throw some dice, and when it gets the result, it makes the decision based on the thrown dice. And it's even true for, like, resolutions of the Apostolic Palace and the UN. The AI could win UN, but it won't win UN unless it just rolls the dice randomly to call that resolution. But also, it'll happily take a voluntary vassal that's going for culture. If you have enough diplo with it, it'll just leave you alone while you go culture or space. It really doesn't recognize upcoming victory conditions very well and prevent them. Not for the human or for other AIs.
I think you can really see this, how much the AI really does not care. If you go into the victory conditions and start disabling some.
Yeah, I don't think it plays differently based on that. In fact, if you play Always Peace, it still spams military.
Maybe it thinks it helps keep the Always Peace by spamming military units so that, you know, if you tried, you would lose.
I think the only conclusion you can really come to is the AI is pretty stupid, but I think we already kind of knew that.
I think we would all like it if the AI did care if it won. However, we wanted to measure that. Of course, I say that, and I'm sure I'm making all the programmers out there just shake their fists at me. It would be nice, certainly if it would take at least into account victory condition point. But, hey, you don't even need to care if you win if you're still having fun.
Does roleplay extensively.
AIs just wanna have fun. Oh, AI. Oh. What?
Do robots dream of electric sheep?
The thread itself was started by Sweet Dude, and he's kind of asking for a guide to trade routes in general. And there is one, if you listeners want to go to the strategy article section. There is an article that details the formula for how the trade routes are valued and all the bonuses and everything. But Cawson posted some links by DanF5771 specifically that have to do with what allows trade networks over sailing passages versus astronomy. The way it works is if there's coast, you can get a trade network or trade route across any of the coast. But if there's an ocean tile, you only get access to that with sailing if it has your cultural borders in it. So you can actually have some situations where you can get trade routes with the target, and the target can't get trade routes back with you if you open borders, and that's very advantageous. And that also translates to if you have astronomy, then you get their trade routes, but they don't get yours. If you meet an AI who has astronomy, you might not want to open borders with it right away. But these are to be distinguished from trade networks in that you don't need open borders to have a trade network. You just need the same potential for a trade route, essentially.
Yeah, another thing you have to remember is that when you're at war, all your trade routes are canceled with the target. So it's not a good idea to just declare war for the heck of it, especially if they're really close to you and those are the only trade routes you have.
Or let's say you decide that you want to declare war on Civilization A, but you need a resource from Civilization B for some of your units, but to get that network in Civilization B, you had to go through Civilization A. So if you're now at war with Civilization A, then you lose not only that trade with Civilization A, but also Civilization B.
I'm not sure if that's true.
No?
I always assumed it would cut trade routes too, but I'm not 100% sure on that. Somebody posted an exception to that or something, and I don't know if it was disproved or not.
Oh, okay, so there might be an exception to that. Well, I guess there could be an exception to everything. That's a very limited situation anyway.
Well, yeah, once people have astronomy, they just go around.
Another thing is multipliers for trading. There's certain things you can build that will give you more trade routes and other things that you can build that will give you more trade route income. Harbors and custom houses and...
Temple of Artemis, it's a wonder. Comes with polytheism. It also multiplies trade route income.
Oh, yeah. And Great Lighthouse...
Two more trade routes per coastal city. It's actually an extremely powerful wonder on maps where you have intercontinental or foreign trade. It's basically worth more than a town per city right away. Like a fully stacked town that's grown from a cottage in terms of the commerce. And you get it pretty much right when you settle a city. It's incredible. A lot of maps, the Great Lighthouse, because of its access to extra trade routes, is stronger than even like Pyramids, for example. Just depending. And also Carthaginian Kothan will add an extra trade route as well.
And by the way, if you're looking at your Civ screen and you think, why don't I have any foreign trade routes, just be sure to check your Civic screen and check you don't have mercantilism or anything like that, because
yeah,
that's definitely a mistake I've made.
You can get foreign trade with vassals if you're in Merc. So that is an incentive to take some vassals. If you're running some crazy conquest with mercantilism and representation or something, you can take advantage of your vassals for trade routes.
Oh, even if you have mercantilism and they have mercantilism too, your vassal?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you still get the trade. I don't think they would, but you do. Neither of you would have trade with other civs. That could be worth it, especially if you're fairly large, because you're denying trade routes to the AIs from you as well. And if you're fairly large, that could be close to as significant as you yourself losing them, especially because you get specialists and they get nothing from you then. Although it really trumps the extra trade route or state property, but in some cases it could. Especially if, like, for example, you want to open borders with them, but they have astronomy and you don't, then you could open borders and run mercantilism and they wouldn't get any benefits, and you can get the Diplo benefit from opening borders.
But if they have astronomy and you don't, you shouldn't really open borders with them. I'm just being paranoid.
No, you should. There's no reason not to. You want to build up the Diplo relations, and the AI doesn't really do a whole lot of intelligent strategic attacking based on its sight of your land. And to my knowledge, it doesn't even drop units onto your land to scout using Galleons. Like, it only runs its initial exploring units through your territory if you open borders. And even then, its use of that is very minimal. It generally just picks a target city that's closest to it and goes for it if it decides to attack you. And it doesn't really ever land specifically to pillage oil or something. I mean, it might missile your oil down or something if it's near your coast and it's got missile cruisers. But even then, it's not really using your map strategically at all. So there's really no disincentive with the AI. Now, with humans, might be another matter.
The defensive or offensive military started by Captain Ajax, and I actually did live in Ajax, Ontario at one point. Ooh, completely unrelated tie-in other than the name. Asks, when you build your military, do you primarily use offensive or defensive units? I'm going to say that I plan for the defensive when selecting military units. However, I do keep a good store of offensive units on hand to take advantage of injured enemy units in the field. I only declare war on a civ if it's for political gain with neighboring friendly civs or to attain a resource or strategic location or city. The poll that's attached to this thread has, of course, defensive or offensive military. Defensive, I just want to keep the bad guys at bay. Or offensive, what's theirs is mine, baby. Emphasis added.
Added by Dan.
Yes. Right now, offensive has 44 of the 57 votes, leaving defensive at 13. I have not yet voted in the poll, but if I click quickly enough, there we go, I will become vote number 45 for offensive.
There you go. I'm in that statistic as well on the offensive side. I am kind of curious what constitutes an offensive versus defensive unit. The only units in the game I can think of that are purely defensive are the archery class. And even then, some people will tow longbows along with their catapults, especially if they're using a protective civ or don't have strategic resources. But anyway, once you have gunpowder, I'd be loath to call rifles a defensive unit, for example, or even infantry.
The only thing after gunpowder that's defensive is the machine gun.
Yeah, the machine gun is. And I guess the ironclad could be construed as a...
Maybe the anti-tank.
I consider anti-tank a stack defender as well. I mean, I guess you can't attack with it outright. I mean, I do because I redline everything with artillery. But yeah, I guess it's a defensive unit, but it's really kind of useless unless you're using it as part of your stack anyway to keep the tanks off of you. I guess it shoots down air, too. But yeah, the main reason offensive is getting so many votes and will almost always beat out defensive units is the way collateral initiative works in this game. It's just too big an importance in war, the way Civ 4 stands right now. Pretty much anything dies to mass collateral, so catapults or cannons or trebuchets or artillery, that kind of stuff, or even air support, will damage everything down sufficiently that you can kill it easily. And if you sit there on defense and wait for that, all your stuff gets hit by collateral anyway. So even though the archery units are cheaper, you lose all of them anyway to siege and die. Whereas if you hit them with your siege first for an equal hammers and then killed their units, you would actually kill their army instead of losing a city.
just thinking more and more about it, I think on Polycast 83, we discussed how siege units were overpowered, and I didn't actually really agree with Kamikaze at that point, but I'm starting to agree more with him that they really are overpowered, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but it really is just too easy to beat them this way.
I was even thinking also offensive or defensive, perhaps as described, it was already touched upon by fellas, how do you describe post-gunpowder, what is a defensive and an offensive unit? So definition is also leading people to think more offensive than defensive. But I would also say that even some earlier units other than post-gunpowder, they could also have a defensive or an offensive capability, and I'll go with siege units. Almost always I will use them offensively, but every once in a while, having them on a defensive purpose, like rather than, say, taking them in to take cities with City Raider, for example, if you had them on Bombard, not only it's what type of unit, but it also depends on your situation. Maybe the people who are voting defensive are more of the builders in terms of going for victory conditions, say, culture or space or time. I had to shudder at that. I couldn't quite, you know, say that without that.
Diplo is the best peaceful victory condition, in my opinion.
Oh, yes, or Diplo. Perhaps they're thinking more of the defensive line anyway. I mean, yes, you use both. You need both in your army, as far as I'm concerned. But in terms of, as you said, do you primarily use offensive or defensive units?
I mean, if you use defensive units for offense, then can't you just consider them offense anyway? That is what Phil talked about.
Yeah. Some of your units you wouldn't want to use as defensive units, like say some of your mounted units, which receive no defensive bonuses, you'd want to use them as offense, but in using them in offense, you are actually defending. It's definitely some shades of gray here.
This is a thread started by Atronax. He created a reference chart for Warlords. Basically breaks down what the AI's tendencies are based on their leaderhead. For example, Genghis Khan, Shaka are way more aggressive than Gandhi or somebody like De Gaulle. Whether you're using this one or the one by Ori or the one by Dan F., it's a good idea to have this handy if you're really playing seriously. You can figure out which AIs are going to declare on you or plot war against you at the pleased disposition. You can figure out which AIs have a tendency to produce more wonders, which ones build the most units. Some of the less aggressive AIs still actually do spam a lot of units, like Sitting Bull, for example, and maybe difficult to rush, so that's good to know. If you download Ori's, I know for sure, I don't know about this one, you can see their piece weights that they tend to be, which is attached to their hidden modifier, so you know if they'll tend to be pleased with each other right from the start of the game or not, and also who they'll favor in terms of attacking. Some AIs care more or less about distance than other AIs, for example, Sitting Bull doesn't care about distance at all, whereas others will very much favor somebody right next to them. I like the numbers one because you can get a relative picture in terms of how much more aggressive this AI is versus another one. Because they'll have like their no war prob as 90, for example, and cautious for Sitting Bull. And that means he'll almost never declare it cautious, whereas somebody else that has a 40 is way more likely to declare.
Forget who put together, there was another chart that we talked about that was similar to this, but it was for Warlords only. Not all of the tabs in here, the ones that I find the most useful would be the second and the third one, the AI breakdown and the AI overview. Not only for instance, providing the numerical values of ranges for personality, wonders, peace, military, aggression, espionage, courage, and raising, but also the layout and the color coding. So at a quick glance, you can see who is more likely or less likely to do something, being more visually easier to look at than the one that we referenced last year. But the fact that this one has also been updated for Beyond the Sword, although I don't know if it's the 319 or not. See, this was last updated July 4th, 2009. Oh, well, I would assume so, because that came out in June. Even though they are Excel files, and I myself prefer using my web browser, there are internal links to things, such as if you're on home, which is the first sheet, and if you click on, say, AI breakdown, in the upper left-hand corner, there's a link to go back to H, which is home, and that's described. You're given that in the instructions. You're told that that's what you can click on to return to this page. You're told that the links in the tables will not work if you change the sorting, and there's even internal links within the sheet. Like if you click on, under AI breakdown, click on espionage, the level of espionage employed by the AI, then it'll jump down farther on that spreadsheet to where espionage appears. It would be nice then to have a link to then just go right back to the top of the page. Some people might find this even more useful or handy than a particular website for, say, the buildings, promotions, text, traits, units, unique buildings, unique units. All of that is in here. But for me, I like the AI breakdown and the AI overview because it's not something I can think of that, oh, hey, I could go to such and such website and get that information.
All of them. It's a lot of work, and it's an extremely valuable resource. So no matter whose you choose to use, it's very nice of them to create these.
And the price is right.
That's right.
Also in this, which I haven't actually talked about, is in addition to this reference sheet, he has included a Civ chooser. The one thing that's even different, as far as I'm aware, from the other guides that you mentioned there, Philip. For instance, step one, please rate the traits based on the bonuses that they give. For example, free combat one promotion for melee and gunpowder units and double production speed of barracks and dry docks. From the drop-down menu, if I said 10, for instance, then I consider that bonus to be outstanding. So then you go through all of those lists about whether you think that the bonuses are outstanding or these bonuses are terrible. Then in step two, please rate the traits based on how often you would utilize their bonuses. So then you do the same thing. 10, I would utilize the bonuses in every single game for the entire game, or I would never utilize the bonuses. So again, on a scale, it goes 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. Then you rate bonuses for the unique unit, how often you would use it. Then rate the bonuses of the unique buildings and how often you would use those unique buildings. Then you rate the civilization's starting technologies, the weight of the leadership traits, select the weight of the unique units, so how important you think they are or aren't. Same with the unique buildings, and then the weight for the starting technologies. And then when you're done with those 11 steps, you click, and what you get is a percentage match of this particular leader in terms of your style. So this is who it is suggesting that you try in order from 1 through 52, which is all of the leaders in the game. If you fail to answer any of these questions, like I did just in this example, you'll get an error. If you're having a hard time deciding who to play or you're finding yourself stuck in a rut, then the Civ Chooser combined with these reference sheets can be a real benefit to you to give you some more variety and expand your gameplay a little bit.
Come on into the research lab where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future.
Stacks of Doom! A solution! All right, I said the topic name. We don't need to discuss it. That's the only reason I chose it. Moving on, there's a... No. So who would like to introduce this topic?
10% for every unit above 3. What the hell?
There's your introduction. No, this thread is by Hans Lemmerson. I hope I'm reading that correctly.
I think so.
The gist of the thread is he's saying that the Stack of Doom is such a predominant thing in civilization that it's incentive to get rid of that. And that's been around for a long time. This particular idea is suggesting a percentage strength penalty, I'm assuming. He just says negative 10%. I'm assuming that's to its base strength in Civ 4 for every unit above 3. And then he goes on to say that stacks are possible, but now you have some disincentive for making absolutely huge stacks. Oh, and then there's a threshold, apparently, for a stacking penalty. Now, this has some interesting gameplay implications, and like any other suggestion, in my opinion, its effects on other aspects of gameplay would have to be considered very carefully. For example, just coming to mind immediately is if you have a stack, then anything over a certain number is extremely vulnerable to flanking. So your siege would go from very powerful to almost useless on the offensive because you'd only have small stacks of units and you wouldn't be able to make a balanced stack anymore and still have sufficient numbers of siege. So you'd just get flanked like crazy if you had like a 30 unit stack because nothing, including your pikes, would be able to defend against like horse archers or knights. Your siege would just die in droves. Whereas if you split your stack up, then if you had spears or whatever to stop the horse archers, then axes would just murder them instead, and the siege wouldn't defend. So all of a sudden, the attacker would go from having at least some advantage in terms of that to having absolutely none. Like, you wouldn't be able to do anything. So you'd have to change the balance of units in that regard as well. It's an interesting idea, but it would be hard to implement it under the current structure of the game.
And on the defense side, if you were limited to only three before you started getting defense penalties, what if somebody rolls up with like three or four of those mini stacks? You're screwed. If you only have three units in the city, even if it has a really good defense, city walls and everything.
That's true. Attacking initiative would be even larger than it is, I guess, currently.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder if it's 10%, as was already said, to the base attack, say, of the attacker, and then on the defensive side, say, minus 10% defensive, and then we can get into the whole offensive-defensive unit discussion again, no thanks. But anyway.
I want to make offensive units even stronger.
You know, I think this is designed, as I said, to get around the stack of doom, but then I'm thinking, man, I'm going to have all of these mini stacks so I don't have this 10% penalty. But actually, I'm starting to think maybe at some point I just want to have that many more units in my stack of doom so that that 10%, especially if it's just from the base, it's going to be of an impact, but I would rather take the 10% penalty with this large stack for every unit rather than having to manage all of these little three or less unit stacks.
Yeah, that's true. The micromanagement would be a big issue as well. I've had some games on higher levels where I controlled over 300 units, and it just would not be fun to move 100 mini-stack individually or whatever. For turn, it would be absolutely devastating in terms of gameplay.
In terms of how historically accurate it is, I was thinking, wouldn't it be more accurate to have, like, a bunch of little stacks of tiny city? Because that's more what it's like. You don't have, like, 200,000 soldiers in one little plot of land.
Well, you do, because of what one plot of land represents in Civ. I mean, that's quite a number of miles in each direction. I mean, this is the same type of tile that an entire city can fit into.
Yeah, but they always complain about it being crowded, so.
Yeah, but that's the civilian population. These aren't organized military ranks. Or maybe they wouldn't complain so much. But no, one tile on Civ, I forget, it's quite a number of miles by miles, and pretty much any army that's ever existed could fit into one, to my knowledge.
At the same time, having the mini-stacks kind of camp out in front of a city, then people would probably pillage more, too. Also, lower in this thread, I think people started saying that instead of a hard cap, we should just have an exponential maintenance sort of cap, which I actually agree with. Because I feel like once you get enough units, really that 10% just doesn't matter anymore. It's like, well, just build three more units, you know?
Yeah, kind of what I was saying. But if it was exponential, oh, yeah. Now you're kind of addressing that point.
Well, I mean, how weak would you make them? Like, if you had a 100-unit stack, would everything be taken down to one strength or zero strength or what? They'd just lose every time, no matter what? It feels a little out of place if you go that far.
Probably not taking more than half.
But even there, you would have things like rifles beating infantry immediately, or like knights absolutely wrecking rifles, just destroying them like nothing.
Well, they can if you don't use them right. So it's like it makes your role more like that of a general rather than, I don't know, a UPS man sending units.
Attacking would be so close to impossible with culture borders and everything else. Because the attacker would get to decide, and the defender would always have the choice of attacking you first. And you would either be forced to split your stacks into stacks that really couldn't defend against a variety of unit attack types, or you'd be forced to take a global penalty on your stack for sending in a big stack. And it would just be frustrating, even with a tech lead and a numerical advantage, to have absolutely no hope against the defender just because he built 20 knights or something and gave them pinch. Because they wouldn't need shock because your pikes would be 3 strength.
Later in the thread, Hands does say that a city will be able to support more units without a penalty than open plains. And he says, sure, defense will be harder when you can't cram a stack of death into your city, but isn't a city with 5 units in it pretty well defended? If you're worried about an impending attack against a city with 5 fortified defenders, you have other problems besides an incremental penalty applied to large numbers of units all sharing the same tile.
See, that's where he's mistaken. The defense would not be harder. It would be nightmarishly easier. You don't defend by sitting in the city. You defend by wrecking the stack right when it gets near it. That's where it would be impossible on the attacker. Sure, you have a strength disadvantage while you're sitting in your city, but when you attack, you don't. So all that collateral gets done, if you even need collateral, with everything at negative 50% health, and then you just attack and just kill all their units. Or they send in things 3 at a time, and you can just block them. Get back to the unit funneling of old. Could you imagine what this would do to the AI if it sent in stacks of 3 at a time? You just park your own 3 units on a hill and force it onto the flatlands, and then... attack it one unit at a time, killing all its units, hundreds of units, five of yours lost at tech parity. I mean, it'd be funny, but I don't know if it's good for gameplay.
King Flevens talks about a hard cap, each tile having a holding capacity for 12, and then cities size 8 to 15 can hold 15 units, and then cities size 15 can have a holding capacity of 20 units. But Moss Cavard says, I believe a much simpler way to resolve the problem is to reintroduce the zone of control system.
No.
Zone of control is which we have discussed on Polycast before. But I think Trias, right on the first page of the thread, says, in general, I would avoid directly penalizing stacks if only on the grounds that penalties are generally unfun and a negative way of dealing with the problem. I still see the argument of concerns people have with regards to stacks of doom. So if you want to continue working on trying to find a way around it, but I don't think that this is the solution. And if you're that concerned about stacks of doom, just remember that you can make stacks of doom just as well as your opponents can. Even if you don't like it, you know its power, so you should be taking advantage of that power.
Have so many units, the stack of doom is such a saver in terms of fun, just being able to actually move all those units in a timely manner. I mean, some people like their games to take 10 hours or more. You know, one of the Beyond the Sword of the Month submissions that won had 66 hours locked, but not everybody likes doing that. And you're going to lose a lot of the audience if you force everybody to have minimum 10, 20-hour games. And that's if they're playing as fast as me. Otherwise, it'll be like 50, because they have to move hundreds of units just to have a chance on the highest difficulties.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Tune into Polycast.
After Polycast.
Nothing replaces Polycast.
Aww.
We don't know how he's comparing that to, though. I mean, if nothing replaces Polycast, is this in the context of...
I think he's talking about it in the Sinead O'Connor song.
I played the fifth.
Nothing compares
to
Polycast.
I think it's only fitting that, Imran, you do the closing to this episode.
All right. You've been listening to episode 85 of Polycast. I am Imran Siddiqui, and I will be leading us out with a few of people I sometimes call friends, but only when they're here, including Daniel Quick.
So long. Farewell. I mixed a couple of songs there, but, you know, you get the idea.
Makalua.
Vidas and goodbye.
Well, that's how it goes.
Yep.
Also with the Mean Team.
Your defensive military is offensive.
And Lisa.
Auf Wiedersehen.
And me again. Goodbye. But I shall be back at some point. Maybe.
That's what he said.
To the three people listening to this out there, which does not include me, because I don't know the last time I listened to one of these. thanks for listening for these past 3 years. I hope you got some minor enjoyment out of something I've said, even though it probably wasn't anything relevant to Civ at all. Farewell, and I shall return as a guest in the future.
Emran, I hold you fully responsible for bringing extra estrogen on the show. Now we're going to have to put up with that, what he said. I don't know about this.
I'm happy to not be outnumbered anymore.
The one created by
Nice.
This one came straight out the end, baby.
Oh, dear.
Wait. wait a second. Maggie just said she dropped, but that was like 4 years. 4 years.
4 years ago.
4 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Yeah. She definitely dropped, but I think it was more like 3 years ago than.
4 years.
4 more years of Polycast. Woo! What?
Well, cheers.
Record date January 2nd, 2010. Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.